Thank you for joining us, Patrick Alonso, just to discuss this issue, the ongoings about the referendum, the political processes. Of course, it has a whole lot of legal implications. My name is Darius Okola, and I'm the curator for audiovisual at the Elephant. Karibu sana, Bwana Patrick Alonso.
Thank you, Bwana Darius.
First of all, what is your view of the Campaign Financing Act, and how do you think it will shape up the political structures of the day?
The Constitution of Kenya in 2010 had several provisions relating to campaign financing, and it required the IEBC to develop regulations, or rather to identify the areas that it can chip in and control the amount of spending by either political parties or independent candidates. And I think we have seen that the IEBC has gazetted some regulations on campaign financing, and they have anchored those regulations on section 88(4) of the Campaign Financing Act, together with the Constitution. And we have seen some tussles that have been brought forward by the parliamentarians. And these tussles are raising eyebrows because, you see, when you talk about parliamentarians being inquisitive as to whether the process was followed in developing these regulations, and they are challenging the fact that IEBC did not involve them in the process. But then you see that the Constitution gives the IEBC the direct mandate. It's one of the functions of IEBC to control campaign financing. So IEBC have come out and defended themselves that they send the draft to the Committee on Delegated Legislation, and the committee probably didn't look at the regulations, but IEBC rushed so that they could overtake time, because the Campaign Financing Act is straightforward that these regulations must be in place 12 months before the general elections. So IEBC rushed to overtake time and published, or rather gazetted, the regulations without getting the input from the parliamentarians. But the parliamentarians are raising issues with that. And it is raising eyebrows, because these parliamentarians are already sitting in parliament. They will be incumbents in the next elections. So, you know, they will not welcome this kind of competition, or rather they have access to resources, you know, but the newcomers have to dig in. The newcomers have to find where they are going to get the campaign financing from. But these guys have the resources. So they are afraid that if the spending is curtailed at some point, they won't have the cutting edge over the newcomers. Yes, when you look at the objective of these regulations, and when you look at the spirit of the Constitution together with the Act, they need they envisage a situation whereby we need to ensure that there is a level playing ground for all the candidates. And we have to accept the fact that in our society, we have the rich, and we have people who are not well endowed with resources. And they would also like to represent the people. They'd also like to be elected into political posts. So are they going to compete against the rich class? This is a very critical and unnecessary step that was taken by the IEBC, and it is a step in the right direction, because it will also lead to the overall goal of free and fair elections.
Okay. I'm just thinking there was also this suggestion to rely on volunteers as returning officers and the respective administrative and logistical roles that go with, you know, the election and the electioneering process. Does that make any legal sense?
I think the main point of departure, we need to look at the IEBC Act and establish what's the definition of probably a returning officer, presiding officer, and I don't know whether they call them clerks or something. And you will notice one common thing, or one peculiar thing. These people are defined to be persons appointed by the IEBC to conduct elections in that capacity, whether it's a returning officer or a presiding officer or a clerk, they are defined as persons that are appointed by the IEBC. So if we have people who feel like, even if they are students, we have teachers, we have nurses, we have social workers, people that have the capacity, and people that in the volunteering form, let's hope they're going to sign volunteerism forms. They are going to show their skills and their strengths. And then IBC is now going to use that form, or rather that information provided by the volunteer, now to categorize them and see where they can be utilized best. And if IBC goes that and now establishes where they can utilize these volunteers, now they can appoint them. There's no need of sitting home during the electioneering period. While you have skills to conduct elections, you can volunteer yourself. Be a change, make that change in the society. And I think that is well within the law.
Okay. What will likely happen for the many people who find themselves sort of indicated as registered in certain political parties, which in actual fact, many have come out and said they didn't? What happens in that sense?
We need to have a conversation around what are the redresses of finding yourself registered with a political party that you did not sign up? And then before we get to the question of redress, how can you actually demonstrate that you did not sign up for this party? Do you have systems? Does the political party's registrar have systems that can demonstrate, or rather if a person comes to them claiming that they did not sign up with a certain political party, but they have find out that they eventually signed up with that political party, do you have a procedure that we can use to verify that these persons did not really sign up with our political party? That's the first question. And then if we get to that position, now we need to come up with redresses. How do we redress that? How do we address that? Of course, now in the question of an independent candidate who finds themselves wrongly signed up with a political party that they did not sign up for. Of course, if they follow that procedure before the elections, the redress will, of course, be that they be allowed to vie as independent candidates because they did not sign up voluntarily. It was involuntary, or rather, they were mistakenly signed up for in that political party. So now, if we get this process of finding out why finding out if a person has been deliberately or indeliberately signed up by a political party, we need to extend the process of making those findings and making the redress so that within these 3 months, because the IEBC Act and Article 85 of the Constitution provides that for you to qualify as an independent candidate, you should not be a member of any political parties 3 months before the elections. So are we going to be within this time frame? Will we come up with a procedure that's within these 3 months time frame so that we get this person at least, if we get this person at least verified declared to vie as an independent candidate because they were wrongly registered with a political party. So I think that's a policy issue that needs to be addressed by the political party's registrar so that at least we avoid locking out independent candidates because they do not comply with Section 33 and Article 85 of the Constitution. Because if you look at the general outlook, or rather how independent candidates are perceived all over the world, they are an additional, they spice up democracy. Because sometimes when you are in the legislature and you're in a certain political party, you sometimes find yourself voting in some patterns because you have to toe the line for the political party. But now the independent candidates do not need to toe the line. They are very independent in reasoning, and that is through innovative legislations to cater for the needs of the people because they are not indebted to their party leaders. They can restore integrity in the parliament and in the government because they can also question decisions of the executive without feeling that they are crossing the line that has been put by their political parties. So I think we need the political parties registrar to come up with a clear procedure of handling those issues.
The election date is slated for August 9th. Is there a possibility of moving it closer or altering that date? And what would it take to achieve that, as insinuated by certain political quarters?
Yes. So when you look at how the Constitution pronounces itself around the election date, it is very clear on the presidential election. It is very clear on parliamentary elections. It is very clear on gubernatorial elections and the election of county assembly members, rather the MCAs, members of the county assemblies. And these elections are primarily and standardly set for the second Tuesday of August, every fifth year after a general election. And that stands not to be changed unless there are compelling issues, which now those compelling issues are contemplated in Article 102 of the Constitution. And these compelling issues are probably the Constitution addresses itself to whether the country is at war or we have a state of emergency. And you know, now the Constitution empowers the Parliament to extend the term of the parliamentary elections, or rather the term of the Parliament. And you know, when you extend the term of the Parliament, you automatically affect the term of the presidency. So the only contemplation is in the event of a war or a state of emergency. The only question would be interpretations around what is a war, because, you know, a war is not defined in the Constitution. And there could be a loophole. We did not have a secondary act, or rather a bill of the Parliament that explains more into the consideration that are to be made in terms of the Parliament extending its term. So we have a loophole in what could be contemplated to be a war or a state of emergency, if we have dubious means of the executive finding its way into declaring a war out of nowhere, or rather declaring a state of emergency. You see, now we'll be automatically in a position whereby the Parliament can extend the term. They'll extend the term for 12 months. After that, now we'll have the elections follow. Because when you look, you need to interpret the Constitution in a way that you understand what the Constitution contemplated, or rather, what was the spirit, what was the drafter thinking. But it is up for debate, you know.
Is the 19 days between the voting date and the gazettement of election results enough? What will happen in the event of an appeal at the courts?
Personally, I do not see anyone rushing to court to challenge those timelines that were issued by the IEBC. Because I agree with those timelines. Timelines are important to ensure that people are well organized. If you give the aggrieved parties too much time, or rather, let's not assume there is any aggrieved party. Let's assume they are political winners, they are political losers. If you give the losers too much time, they will have enough time to craft petitions, to craft grounds for petitions. But people that really feel they have lost because of substantial issues arising from the election will have that feeling even a day after the declaration of the results. They will know that there have been issues. They will know that they had a majority vote, and they were not. There was an election irregularity. But if you give people so much time, you open the process to abuse, because we have seen everywhere, even in the just concluded USA, United States of America elections, the timelines are very strict. You have to prepare your petition within 7 days after the elections are declared. You have to rush to court within those 7 days. And we have also seen those issues arise even in our own election petitions, whereby in 2017, some documentary evidence by the NASA coalition were not accepted by the court because they were time-barred, you know, It is an issue that can be contested by people who foresee that the election will not be fair. But if we believe in our electoral system, if we believe in the IEBC, we are not going to run to court to challenge this. That's my personal opinion. We'll not have people challenging the timelines, because if you also run to court to challenge the timelines, maybe on grounds of legality, on grounds of fairness and whatnot, people will also perceive you to be already have predetermined your loss or something, to predetermine that the elections will not be fair, which is also not a nice thing. And the constitution on the presidential elections, it requires that the IEBC will forward the name of the presidential election winner to the Chief Justice within 7 days. And then after the 7 days, the aggrieved party is given some timelines to file a petition. In county elections and parliamentary elections, the amount of time given for an aggrieved party to file a petition is 28 days from the date of gazettement. And because the constitution pronounces itself to declare from the date of declaration as a winner, gazettement amounts to declaration that a particular person has won the elections. So I feel like the 28 days from the date of declaration, they are sufficient. The 28 days are sufficient to file a petition. So I don't see people running to court to challenge these timelines.
Okay. Thank you. I'm also thinking, what are the other ways in which citizens can participate in politics and governance, basically, you know, in between the elections and away from the usual five-year voting cycle?
I think the issue that we have with Kenyans, we are conditioned to think that our problems will only be solved in the electoral process. Or rather, the people that we elect are the only people that are going to determine our fate, which is very wrong, because you can all elect someone who does not represent your interests, but they had misrepresented to you that they will represent your interests. So what happens in the near future? Because this such a person will be in the parliament, will be in the county assembly, will be your governor, will be your president for the next 5 years. So how are you going to deal with that? I think the constitution of Kenya has entrenched a very critical element of governance, taking governance to the people. And this is through public participation. When you look at Article 118 of the Kenyan Constitution, it provides for public participation to be considered in the legislative process by the National Assembly. Article 196 also encourages the county assemblies to consider public participation in their legislative processes. When you look at the County Government Act, Section 115, it also requires that when the county is doing its county planning, they have to conduct public participation. You need to listen what Wanjiku says. When you look at also the Public Finance Management Act, which is largely the act that governs what happens with our public monies, the public monies that are spent by the government, it requires that there must be set, or rather, there must be developed public participation structures for the purposes of the better carrying out of the act. And why is public participation so important in governance? It is because whoever is sitting in that decision-making chair is not making a decision for himself. He's making a decision that affects the common Wanjiku, or rather the common Mutiso. And Mutiso needs to have their inputs. You need to listen to Mutiso, whether that bill that you're proposing addresses the issues that Mutiso is experiencing at the lowest level that he is. Because when you're sitting in the National Assembly in Nairobi, you do not connect with all the issues that are being experienced by the common man. And then they are going to reply that, no, Mheshimiwa, here you are wrong. This is not what is happening. This is not what we want. This is what we want. This is not what we want. Democracy itself is a subset, like public participation is a subset of democracy. We cannot say we are democratic if we do not take public participation. And therefore, how do we make the people understand that the constitution and other laws give them the power to make decisions together with the elected representatives? And it is civic education that leads to public participation. So civic education leads the people into understanding their role in public participation. And now it is upon the courts to decide what is sufficient public participation. People also need to be educated that you can also go to court to enforce that your inputs be considered in that bill, because your inputs as given, they were not considered. You need to be given reasons why they were not considered, you know? So let's not have public participation as a cosmetic process. Let's have also the enforcement bit. Let's have people, if we are citizens, we give our bits on public participation. Let's follow up. Let's see if our inputs were incorporated. If they were not, go to court. Yeah, that is my take on that. Just before we conclude on that question, we also need to have the private sector in Kenya pump in their resources and even their time into this civic education. Do not wait for the government to be the only arm that to be the only institution that conducts civic education. Because at times, if you expect the government to conduct civic education on matters that are going to conflict with their interests, you will not have that done. So let's have the private sector also chip in. Let them educate the people. Let's also have the political parties. That's their primary role. Let's have the political parties go to the people, give them civic education on matters of governance and all that. Thank you.
There have been certain challenges with implementation of the constitutional provisions. Key among them, let's say the two-third gender rule. How do we then go about solving that impasse?
As a lawyer, I would have loved to get into the minds of the drafters of the 2010 constitution. These noble men, each one of them is a man I respect very much, Professor Kivutha Kibwana. They had the idea of empowering the female gender. But now, if you look at the way this empowerment is envisaged, or rather is institutionalized in our constitution, it is very hard to achieve the same. Because as you have put it, you have now the two-third gender rule requires that in all elective and appointed positions, you shall not have more than two-thirds occupying the same. You have two-thirds female and a third male. Two-thirds male and a third female. Now, look at the elective posts. It is easy for these to be realized in the appointive post, because appointment does not go to the people. There is a body that is making that decision, and that body ought to be regulated, ought to comply with this provision, because the constitution requires that they should not appoint more than two-thirds of the same gender. So that is easy to comply with. Now let's go to the elective posts. Are you going to comply with the electing? How many constituencies do we have? How are you going to make sure that out of those members of parliament, you have a third from one gender and two-thirds from the other gender? Strictly, that is not possible, because the people who are electing these people, the electorate, if they do not consider that while they are going to cast the ballot, are you going to reverse their decision? Of course not. You'll not reverse their decision, because it is also their right to vote for whoever they feel like voting for. So you find that we had some propositions from, you look at the Chepkonga bill, the Duale bill, that was seeking to amend the constitution so that they achieve the progressive realization of the two-third gender rule as advised by the Supreme Court, while the Chief Justice Emeritus Mutunga was in office. which I think Supreme Court advised the Parliament very well, that we need to realize these provisions progressively. So these can only be achieved through party nominations. That's my feeling. If we regulate, or rather we have provisions as to how parties are going to nominate, so what we are going to, what their reasoning was, we need to go back to Parliament. Let the Parliament see how they can address this issue through a progressive bill that caters for the two-third gender rule. And it is wholly through the party nominations, because that is the other avenue that is left after you have the general elections. You elect your MPs. From that number of MPs that are elected, you do your maths, and you will find out how many female MPs you need to nominate so that you balance the equation of the two-third gender rule. And the Duale Bill had proposed that we come up with this criteria of nominating extra females into the parliament for a time of 20 years, after 20 years, it is envisioned that now we'll have a level playing ground. Now we'll have the female MPs now getting elected now at the grassroots level. The bill was going to be operative only for 20 years, but the bill was shot down. It was supported by the president. We had the opposition leader, Raila Odinga, support it, but it didn't see the light at the end of the day. And the bill was shot down. So now we are back to square one. And that's why we had also the retired Chief Justice Emeritus advise the president to dissolve the parliament, because the parliament had not adhered to the advisory that was issued by the Supreme Court before he came into office. Now, that judgment by the Supreme Court had put it clear that if the parliament does not enact a bill to operationalize the two-third gender rule by 27th August 2015, the parliament itself would be unconstitutional, because it will not have satisfied the provisions of the constitution. And the parliament sat back and extended the deadline for a further one to August 2016, which they also did not comply with. That is why the former Chief Justice advised Parliament to be dissolved, because it was unconstitutional as per the judgment by the Supreme Court. And this shows where we are as a country. But now you're seeing that things are changing. Yeah, we are expecting a judgment that might go against the wishes of the president, as we saw at the High Court. And it shows that we are evolving anyway. As at now, where we are, and departing from the judgment by the High Court annulling the BBI process, I think we are heading towards the right direction, that we can have a Kenyan court, African court, nullify an initiative that was undertaken by the president. That is democracy. That is jurisprudence that has never been seen in Africa. It is very new.
And just in closing, how has devolution fared, squared out in the last two terms? And do you think the current proposed changes to the devolution question are necessary, and do they need an amendment?
I think just the main amendment to the constitution that touches on devolution is on expanding, rather increasing the allotment by the national government to the county government from 15% to 35%. And it is always my position that the current constitutional dispensation that we have provides that the national government shall disburse 15% to the counties, at least 15%. So if they want to achieve the 35%, whether they amend the constitution or not, they will still achieve the 35%. It is personal decisions by the national government not to allocate the 35% as at now, but they can do that as early as tomorrow if they wanted to. But anyway, let's look at it as holistic, because now the minimum is 15%. So honestly, if you're sitting at the National Treasury, if you're sitting at the presidency, you will decide to just give them the minimum that the constitution provides for them. But if they say the minimum are 35, that is very much welcome, and you are going to accept that. Only if they are going to honor that, if they are going to comply with that 35%. So devolution has panned out in a manner that we can say it has really revolutionized governance in Kenya. It has brought a lot of changes. It has taken decision-making to the people. The matters of public participation that we mentioned earlier, we have counties adhering to public participation to the latter. It has trickled down development to the people. It has balanced the county's economic development, because at least now you don't have a president sitting at the house at the hill deciding that let's have all the development head or rather all the resources head to a particular region. Now at least we have a balanced economic development, because the constitution provides for equitable sharing of revenue. And we also have expanded the political space. At least we have now people vying for governors, senator, for county assembly members. So it has also expanded the political space. And key to note is that our healthcare, if as a county, you have been keen with delivering the healthcare services to your people, it has really taken care of our healthcare systems. In some of the counties that have taken serious responsibility with devolution roles, it has really changed the healthcare system. And even the ECDE, the counties, the devolution is experiencing some challenges, which is lack of resources, which now is being addressed through the 35%. But the biggest challenge is fiscal challenges. We need to decentralize the fiscal responsibility. Let's have the counties being given their money and spending it from the county itself. Because now if a county wants to spend money, it has to get a lot of approvals from the treasury. That is the main challenge.